I appreciate the opportunity to spend this time with you. J.D. Tant, my grandfather, not me, but I'm the third. My son is the fourth. My grandson is the fifth. But just had a great grandson born a couple of months ago, and they've cut the line. So no more J.D. No more J.D. Tants. But he, as he said, he was, in a sense, a legend in his own time. And there'd be no way that I could continue to tell the whole story about him. But as you said, there's a book, J.D. Tant, Texas Preacher. And I know a lot of preacher training programs, they require that. That's required reading for the young men if they want to be in that program. My father wrote that book in 1957. And then sometime later, he wrote the biography of my grandmother, Nanny Yeter Tant. My grandfather was born June the 28th, 1861. He was the son of William and Mattie Lloyd Tant. He was born in Cartersville, Georgia, well, a community called New Hope Church. New Hope Church, of Irish descent. And there's a story about the name. Supposedly, an ancestor had been a Catholic priest in Ireland and had fell out of favor with the church in some way. And and fled Ireland and came to America to escape persecution. And he had four brothers, Thomas, Andrew, Nathan, and Timothy. T-A-N-T. That's the family story. This place where he I live about 30, 40 miles from where my grandfather was born, in 1861. So what took place in 1861?
War.
Beginning of the Civil War.
Beginning of the war.
Yeah.
My great-grandfather had settled in Paulding County and a very successful farmer. He had 11 farms. No slave labor. He only had hired hands. He had no slaves. But when my grandfather was 8 days old, his father left to join the army, Confederate Army. He was not a slave owner, but since the Yankees had invaded the South, well, then he felt they needed to defend their home territory. 4 years later, after suffering untold hardship and without a leave or a furlough, he came back home for the first time, and it was devastation. Sherman's armies had come through the territory, burning, destroying everything in sight. And the house where my great-grandmother and the children were living, they came, that they looked for, you know, whatever contraband they could steal, and they found nothing, and they burned the house down, everything around there, with my great-grandmother and children there under an oak tree, and they shot the dog standing between my grandfather's legs and left him with nothing. They scavenged around the fields or in the area to see if there were any stalks of grain that had not been taken, and they would take that. They dug up the dirt under the smokehouse and boiled the dirt to reclaim whatever salt there was, and that was the subsistence for 4 years. They had burned the courthouse and all the deeds and everything, so when my great-grandfather got home, he hired a lawyer to put things back in order, a fellow named Babe Forsyth, who got all the deeds together and made them out to himself, sold the farms, and skipped the country. And we have the county north of us is Forsyth County. So things were pretty tough. They moved then to South Georgia, where my great-grandfather thought they could find some sustenance there. He built a wagon, and they found a couple of oxen just, you know, orphaned, and he harnessed them up, and that took them down there. But things still didn't go very well. But you can imagine that even many years later, my grandfather, his thoughts about that. In fact, my grandfather said he was a grown man before he learned that "damn Yankee" was two words. It was all one word. You know, a lot of stories about all this. Brother Fort Wallace was mentioned, and when we lived in Oklahoma City, my dad was preaching with 10th and Francis Church then, about 1,000 members or so. And Brother Foy lived one block away from us. And we spent a lot of time together. In fact, he was Uncle Fooey. I was about 10 years old, and I've got some books he gave to me, signed, you know, from Uncle Fui. A couple of other stories, you know, somebody mentioned about the One Cup Brethren. My father said, you know, in a lot of small towns around, just a few people there, and if somebody's brother or uncle or somebody came to visit a Christian, they would ask him to help serve the Lord's table, lead singing, do something, you know, other. So here's the One Cup Church, and they invite somebody's relative to serve the Lord's Supper that Sunday. There's an old gentleman sitting on the front row over there, so he took the cup and went over and gave it to him. Just the whole cup. Afterward, they apologized that we should have told you we saved him for the last. Because when the Lord said, drink you all of it, he does. That'll work. That'll work pretty well. That'll work pretty well. You mentioned about Custer, the last stand, and all like that. I heard a story about that a painter had been commissioned to paint a mural about Custer's last stand, in a sense depicting what must have gone through Custer's mind as he was viewing all these Indians down there in the battle. And so they had the unveiling ceremony and drew the curtain, and here was Custer standing on a hillside, and up in the sky was a cow with a halo around it and a lot of Indians down here picking cotton. What do you mean? He said, well, Custer must have thought, holy cow, where'd all these cotton-picking Indians come from? Anyhow, after a few years in the South, the family moved to Texas. A lot of people in the South moved to Texas where there was land and maybe a new opportunity. And so they left. My great grandfather never fully recovered from the difficulties he'd had. He was able, you know, to help provide for the family, but he was never quite the same man as he had been when he left. And he was with Lee at Appomattox when Lee surrendered to Grant. My great grandfather was with him. And even 70 years later, my grandfather really had, you know, difficulties about the struggles they had. I was 6 years old when my grandfather died. They had a family reunion in 1939 when I was four, down the Rio Grande Valley. And my one memory of my grandfather, they had an adobe house. And if you know adobe houses, you know, mud bricks and, you know, they'll cracks and all like that. And an aunt was in the bedroom taking a nap, and a snake crawled into the bedroom. And she saw that, began to scream and holler. My grandfather went in there and got that snake and took it outside to dispose of it. They came to the living room where I was, and I jumped on the couch to get out of the way. So that's my memory of my grandfather as a snake killer. So that's that's my memory of him as a snake killer. There was not much schooling available in his childhood. He did get to attend a subscription school for a time, but the tuition was required. And about all his dad could afford was about 6 weeks of schooling. But that very brief encounter lit something in him that he really became interested in that. Later on, as they were in Texas, he started going to school, but didn't have the tuition, didn't have any books. Well, he was able to go, but he didn't have any books to study from. And he, you know, scrounge around the other kids at their desk and all, and look over their shoulders, and they began to curse him and, you know, all that. So he made an arrangement with a teacher to leave the window unlocked at night. So at night, he would come and get in the classroom and study the books. The next day in class, he knew all the answers. He did exceptionally well, better than most of the students, and they had no idea how he was learning because they knew he didn't have any books. And they said people used to come from miles around to see the tad idiot boy that learned his lessons without no books. That was his reputation for all that. But he had a lifelong desire for learning. He joined the Methodist Church when he was 14 years of age. Methodist Church was in the community where they're in Texas. Well, that was in, before they left to Texas. He was in Georgia. And when they got to Texas, He was also interested in the church, Winard, and he learned some music and did some teaching of singing school in the Methodist Church. And he was ordained as a Methodist preacher when he was 17 years of age. He said it required more lung power than brain power, and he thought he qualified. So they ordained him. And then he began to search through the scriptures to find appropriate scriptures to read for marriages and for baptizing babies. Well, he read through and didn't find anything about babies. He did find some appropriate passages for marriage, but nothing for babies. He said, well, it must be there. We wouldn't be doing it. So he read through again, and it wasn't there. It wasn't there. But he really wanted to be right, and he also wanted to confront those Campbellite preachers with something that would shut them up that came through the community. Well, didn't find much of anything. The family then moved to Buda, Texas, B-U-D-A, a few miles south of Austin, and he had a singing school going and was preaching in a revival. And since the Methodists never paid him a cent for his work, the move did not involve any financial sacrifice. And hoping things might improve. But they didn't. And then he got a job on a ranch as a bronc buster. He didn't know much about horses, but he learned. And he was paid $5 a head to break a horse. And even for some time, sometimes he would go off to a meeting somewhere and take a wild horse, and that was his transportation, to break the horse on the way, and he got paid for it. So he was thinking he was doing pretty well. And he had several he was working on at the same time. He was a preacher, taught singing school, picked cotton, bronc buster, did some school teaching, and even considered selling books. At one stage. Those years, he once wrote, I preached all summer in protracted meetings and picked 300 pounds of cotton each day, then preached at night for weeks at a time. So some of this is why it suggested that any young man wanting to preach needs to read the life of not only him, but other pioneer preachers who really, really suffered in order to preach because they love the gospel. So less than a month after they moved in Buda, he learned that a fellow named W.H.D. Carrington was in town, a Campbellite preacher. And he rode over one evening and was really deeply shaken at Carrington's preaching from the very first sermon. And all the old doubts he had about the Methodist doctrines then returned. And he would go in at night and maybe study the Bible most of the night after hearing Carrington preach. And followed then on August the 14th, 1881, he turned from Methodism, openly weeping as he gave the aged Carrington his hand. And they shook him in on his Methodist baptism. Why? Because the Methodist immersed. And this was a controversy then between the gospel advocate and the firm foundation that was started by McGarry, I think, as to which is the correct idea. Do we accept the Methodists just because they immerse, or what? It's interesting that I've got a knife at home that belonged to General Antonio Santillana, the Mexican general who stormed the Alamo. McGarry's son, Isaac McGarry, was a great friend of my grandfather's, and he was a soldier that guarded Santa Ana the night that he was captured in the Battle of San Jacinto. Sam Houston had a kind of a ragtag army, and they came in the middle of the night when they were all asleep. Kind of reminds me of a story in Judges, the 6th and 7th chapter, Joshua in the Battle of Jericho. No, this is before that.
Gideon.
And so, you know, he would have taken a souvenir from this famous fellow who was the president of Mexico and the general of the army. And I think in later years he gave that to my grandfather, because my grandfather had all kind of, he's got a key to the Bastille and all kind of stuff like that. There were over 100 items that he had. When my grandfather died, my grandmother put the stuff in boxes up in the attic and rented out the house, and through the years most of the stuff disappeared. But an aunt finally got about 18 pieces and parceled it out among the grandchildren. I've got two or three things that he had. Yeah. So he began, you know, as soon as he was shaken in, he began to preach. He was ordained, and I've got the certificate of ordination, you know, of the couple of elders of the church wrote authorizing him to preach the gospel. And so he began then. That's in 1881. Well, this is a picture of my grandfather about the time that he was converted. This is 1880. He was age 19 years of age. Would anybody know what kind of material this picture is on?
Tintype.
Yeah. Daguerreotype is the
right.
And you know, and it's that's him, and up there it says 1880. So I found this among some of the stuff. I got stuff all over the place. My grandfather's library, my father's library, and my stuff, and I just dig through stuff sometimes. But I was just fascinated to find this and looking through stuff, and so, well, I gotta share that with the people. And I see it much similar there to my father in the picture, if any of you knew my father, Yeter Tant. In 1882, my grandfather rented a small farm on the shares from a good crop, which he made $1,700. And he moved his parents there. And in 1883, he received his first compensation for preaching. $9.75 for the entire year. And $5 of that came from a wedding ceremony. So I'd have paid him $5, you know. So he did fairly well for a while there with his farming and his preaching. Of course, right now, during this period of time, we're having the division taking place over the Missionary Society and the instrumental music in the churches. And he did a lot of preaching talking about that. He was acquainted with an older man named C.D.M. Wilmoth, and my granddad became sort of a Timothy to this older preacher, worked with him for a time. It's not unusual for him to hold a 2 or 3 week meeting. You know, they'd hold a meeting 2 weeks, maybe baptize 50 people, and say, well, let's go on another week or two, which was pretty common back then. Now then, we're down to weekend meetings, and times have changed in many respects. In 1886, well, you know, and during these meetings, he would often do not one cent of support. Sometimes they would promise to pay later. Some did, but most of them didn't. In 1886 is when the Missionary Society was formed at a state meeting in Houston. They gathered people from churches all over the state to decide what they're going to do. And that's when they voted to begin the Missionary Society. And that began then. Of course, we're going on with the instrumental music issue. I think L.L. Pinkerton in Midway, Kentucky in 1859. Is that right? Yeah, 1859. He said the singing was so bad it would scare the rats away. So they had to do something about that. And they brought in the melodeon then to help them with their singing. Well, that's, you know, we have then the Churches of Christ and the Disciples, or the Christian churches, came out of this over about a 50-year period of them trying to decide what we're going to do and settle matters in their mind till, was it U.S. Census in 1906 that they saw, yeah, they're two separate groups now and were listed from them after that. In 1884, when Austin McGary began the firm foundation to oppose the advocate on this matter of baptism, rebaptism was a major issue at the time, and for many years that was a major discussion among the brethren, and my grandfather was on the side of the advocate. that they would accept somebody immersed somewhere else without any question. My grandfather wrote for the Advocate for some years, but then was banned from the pages because he was pretty plain in his speech. And a lot of brethren were getting a little more couth, you know, a little more urbanized, and they didn't like his plain speech. So he was banned for some time. But then later, David Lipscomb repented and took my father back in. I think he was front page editor for some time. And the strange thing, I should have put a picture up of his handwriting. His handwriting was horrible. If he wrote something that somebody needed to read, my grandfather would transcribe it for him. But my father, years later, my grandmother had been dead a long time, my father would go somewhere and somebody would say, "Brother Tant, your father wrote me this letter 30 years ago, and I haven't been able to read it yet. Could you decipher it for me?" But my dad got pretty good at doing that. And in the book, Texas Preacher, my dad's got a page there showing the terrible handwriting my father had on that. So he was glad to be able to go back again. But later, my grandfather was convinced he needed to be baptized. And he got on his horse and rode 120 miles to find a fellow to baptize him for the remission of his sins. He decided that he needed to be sure about that. And so a fellow named John H. Durst baptized him in 1886. Now then, he's 25 years old, he's not married, and he decides it's about time to do something like that. So they had a state meeting in Austin, Texas in 1886. And he went to the meeting not only to see how things were going, but he went there to look for a wife. He thought he should marry, a man should marry about the age of 28, and he was looking for a wife, and looked for all the young women at this meeting, he looked them over, and picked out three that seemed to interest him. And when it came time to take a vote, he noticed that two of them voted for the more liberal side, and one voted for the conservative ideas. And he went to her and told her he was there looking for a wife, and would like to correspond with her for a time if she's agreeable, with a view to them getting married in time. And Laura Warren agreed. He said, "I told her my intention was to marry in 5 years. If she could see nothing across her pathway that would prevent her from being the wife of a Christian minister, we would commence a correspondence." And that did correspond for 4 years. And they met only four times, but they married on March the 26th, 1890. She was a teacher in Austin, Texas, in the schools there. Later, she bore him a son and a daughter. The son, Ira, died at age 10. And my grandfather was off, way off in a meeting somewhere, and could not get back. And he wrote a tearful letter expressing regret that, but, you know, you didn't have airplanes, you didn't have, you know, much way to get around much then, and he was just unable to get home. Laura, his wife, died pneumonia in 1894. They'd just been married 4 years. And they had a son that died, and then the daughter. And of course, all this time, the division is going on. And in spite of all he and other faithful brethren could do, four out of five churches in Texas were lost in the digression. They went off the wrong way, along with their property, of course, and Adran College, which was a Christian college back then. My grandmother, I went to school there, even. Well, the eternal problem of paying the bills was always with him. And now he had two motherless children to care for. And that was weighing on him, but he began debating. He had his first debate when he was 25 years old, and during his lifetime had over 300 debates. Denominational people would debate back then because they believed something. Uh-huh. Today they don't believe anything. Everybody's okay, you know. Joel Osteen. Joel came to Atlanta. You ever hear of Joel Osteen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Came to Atlanta a while back and was interviewed on TV and newspaper. "I don't preach on sin. God hadn't called me to do that. I want my people to feel good." That's how you get 40,000 members. But their stadium only seats 17,000. Then here, I'm sure you saw this a few some weeks ago. His wife said, "Oh, when you come to church, you're singing praise. You're not doing this to praise God. You're doing this to make yourself feel good." Didn't y'all see that? Unreal. Unreal. Well, you know, such men as my grandfather, Joe Warlick, and others were great debaters, had many debates, and they would debate with him until finally they were decided it wasn't good to debate because they didn't win much. My father said often they did not believe in debates for the same reason that a muley cow does not believe in hooking. Okay, so what is a muley cow? It's been dehorned. So they don't have anything to hook with, so they don't believe in hooking. In 1887, they moved to Hamilton, Texas, where he lived for 15 years, the longest time that my grandfather lived in any one place. It was the only place that really seemed like home to him, but even so, it was a life of unnecessary hardship because of untaught brethren who would not support preachers. And this was not just my grandfather. It was pretty common back then for preachers to go. Had they not loved the cause, they would have not paid the terrible price that they had to pay in order to preach. At the time, the farm just wore out. It was not productive, and they were moved many times through the years. Moved to New Mexico, moved in Tennessee and Arkansas. In fact, in Rogers, Arkansas, where my father was baptized, and his older sister, Moselle, both baptized at the same time. My grandfather had both of them on his arm and put them under in a river there. I'd never known of that happening before. When they were in New Mexico, they were moving back to Texas during the winter time, and there were dirt roads and some mountain passes and all like that, and I guess they had a hay frame, on a wagon that was too wide for the narrow road they were on, so they had to unpack everything, take it off, and then go around the bend, and my father fell off the wagon somewhere in the snow and created quite a commotion for grandmother. But, my grandmother, I haven't got to her yet. Have I yet? Okay, they're coming later. Texas, New Mexico, Arkansas, Tennessee, Mississippi, back to Texas. And most everywhere he went, he was farming in order to support his family and enable him to preach. At one place, he had a very successful meeting, and the brethren invited him to come back for the next year. And they could not pay him now, but he said, "Well, all right, I will come back next year." They raised pigs there. That was the main occupation. They were hog farmers. He said, "All right, if you brethren will take the runt of the litter and feed it the slop off your table, and I'll take that as my pay when I come next year. Take this runt of the litter." And they got pencils out, began screwing on. "Oh, Brother Tam, we can't afford to do that. We can't afford that." And so his reply was, rather bluntly, "If you don't love the Lord enough to give him the slop from your table, as far as I'm concerned, you can go to hell." He was rather plain in his speech. Rather plain. He went up into Oklahoma during Indian Territory days and preached among the Indians up there. He said one night he was around the campfire with them, and they had some chitlins, that intestines or whatever like that, that they'd swing around and pop it at somebody, and they would grab a bite of it, not eat of it, you know. I don't think he partook in that, but that was, you know, what they were doing. But even though he had very little formal education, he did have a great interest in education and played a significant role in the founding of Childers Institute, which is now Abilene Christian University, as well as Cordell Christian College up at Oklahoma, which does not exist anymore. Roy Cogdell went there to Cordell Christian College for a time. And my grandfather helped some 27 different young men and women attend these schools. In later life, he was somewhat critical of the schools because he thought they tried to be an adjunct to the church, which he didn't think they needed to be. They needed to be supported by individuals, not the church. One time when he was in Abilene, was there for the lectureship, I think, which began in 1903, somewhere along there. But he was walking down the steps of the auditorium, fixing to leave town, and he told some of the people with him, he said, "I'm fixing to do something the devil himself wouldn't do." "What's that?" He said, "I'm leaving Abilene." We've probably all done something like that. We've done something that maybe Satan himself wouldn't do. But when his wife died of her pneumonia, he was so overwhelmed that he just found it impossible to think of another marriage for a time. Yet he knew that his children needed to have a mother. And being constantly involved in meeting work, he had the opportunity to meet many young women. But he was somewhat reluctant to try to impose upon them the difficult life it was going to be as a farmer preacher's wife with these two children. And finally, after a temporary interest in a couple of young women, he finally settled upon Nanny Green Yater of Grandview, Texas. She was well-educated. She was a school teacher and a devout Christian, and they were married at her mother's home in 1896. He was 11 years older than my grandmother. He was born in 60. She was born in 71. He got in trouble. He had written a letter to her mother on some occasion before they married, and she had sons that were there that they were married, and he addressed his letter to the old lady Yater. That did not go over well. Her brothers were about to whip my grandfather when he came to town, but he just said, "I didn't know her first name, and I knew that she was the oldest one there." So, so they got it settled, and they had it was a double wedding. They got married, and another in the family, one of the sons, got married. Her brothers, often the Yater boys, became doctors. Some of them. The word Yater was a German name. Peter Yater was born on a boat coming across in 1825 from Germany. And as you go to Ellis Island, a lot of people are illiterate, and they come to Ellis Island to be registered where they got off the boat, and they'd say, "My name is, you know," and they just write down something. So we got it spelled J with a Jeter, Y-E-A-T-E-R. Got two or three different spellings. You're often the same family, but just came at different times, and whoever the clerk was, they just write down something, you know. So there's a lot of variations in family names because of their experience at Ellis Island. But he was very honest with Nanny and told her that she'd have a hard life with him. And he said, "In these times, I can only promise I will love you with all my heart and strive and pray that I'll ever be true to you and never disappoint you. Such is a poor recompense indeed for so great a sacrifice on your part." My grandmother was a widow for 20 years. He died at age 80, and she was 89 when she died. She lived with us. She divided her time among three of the children. They had six children. And she lived with us when I was a teenager. And never once did I hear her utter a word of complaint for the hard life that she lived. Not once. She learned to type when she was in her 60s. My father was editor of the Ancient Landmarks, which was a little paper made for non-Christians. And she wrote to churches all over the country telling about this paper. Her goal was to write three letters a day. And she said, "If there's one soul in heaven as a result of my work in this, it'd be well worth it." And my dad paid her. He paid her so she'd have a little bit of spending money. So he paid her to write these letters, which she did faithfully as she learned to type and did that. One of my grandfather's debates was with a fellow named Pig, P-I-G-U-E. Well, they gathered for the debate, a big crowd, and my grandfather wasn't there. Pig and his moderator sitting up here on the platform, and they kept waiting for Elder Tant to show up. Finally, they said, well, they began to make fun, you know, "Well, he's not coming, you know, the Camelites can't do anything, you know." About that time, grandfather stood up on the back row, dressed in overalls, farm clothes. I'm here. So my pappy told me, when you go for a hog killing, you need to dress for the occasion. As he began writing in 1909, he began to warn, "Brethren, we are drifting." I would say, he might say today, we have drifted. I just learned yesterday of the largest Church of Christ in Atlanta. They're moving in instrumental music. Abilene, where I went to school after Florida College, on the lectureship, they had a prominent woman Methodist pastor, one of their speakers. Pepperdine, offering scholarships to homosexuals to diversify. They got a LGBT, whatever all that is. They got a group on campus. I went to high school with one of the fellows that's in the administration out there. And I called him the other day and I said, "Joe, what's this all about?" He tried to play it all down. But I had the article in newspaper right in front of me. I knew what I was talking about. They're just trying to diversify, attract more students, I guess. And I won't go on. Y'all know all these things going on. In his older years, he stayed busy, but was still beset by financial problems. One time in Tennessee, bought a farm, got a pretty good deal, and then he subdivided it into acreage and let brethren who needed help buy certain acres, and then they would pay him out of their crops, you know, to repay what he had paid to buy the place, and almost nobody did. Just left him, you know, broke. Had to finally move somewhere, I think, back to Texas about the time. And, you know, in his older years, he still stayed busy. Had these programs. He wrote to some of the congregations that had promised to send him support for the meeting he held for them, but they never did, asking them to remember the promise, but they never did. But some older people personally did send some money to help him out. He said there'll be a lot of straightening up the day of judgment. He liked to tell stories. Had a lot of stories to tell. One place he went and having dinner with the family, and here's a cup of coffee in front of him. And he asked the sister, "Do you have any coffee beans?" "Well, yes, Brother Tan, I bought some today." You know, often they ground their own coffee then. You didn't buy it in a package in the store. He said, "Well, if you'll bring me a couple of coffee beans, I'll put them here in the saucer and I'll smell this while I drink this lukewarm water you put out for me." On another occasion, he was met at the train station by a brother, and they got in their buggy and started towards home. And this fellow said, "Now, Brother Tapp, we get out to the house. You're going to meet my wife." He said, "She's not much to look at, but she's a wonderful wife. She really is, you know." And he went on and on about this, but grandfather got tired of it. When they got to the house, and his wife came to meet him, he said, "Now, Brother Tapp, I know she's not much, but beauty's only skin deep, you know." And grandfather said, "Before God, brother, she's my wife. I'd take her out behind the barn and skin her before morning." But he wasn't going to be put up with all the stuff, you know. Yeah. Well, he's the beginning of our work in foreign fields. He went to Cuba in 1920 to preach there. This was not common among our brethren back in those days. My father has also done some work in other nations. And my wife and I, well, when I was in school, my roommate was a fellow named Dale Smeltzer. And Dale and I visioned going as far someday as the Virgin Islands to preach, you know, down off the coast of Florida. Dale and his wife lived in China for a time, lived in Prague, Czechoslovakia. My wife and I have been in some 30 different nations. Been going to Jamaica, working there for about 29 years, and Malaysia, the Philippines, and it's just, the world's a lot smaller than it was a long time ago. But here he started all this, and I wish I'd brought the thing with me to read the description. They talked about the shape of his nose, his eyebrows, all kind of stuff on the passport. to identify who he was, so they'd be sure that the fellow who had the passport was the one described on it. But 1920, he would have been 60 years old.
Yeah.
60 years old at the time.
Yeah.
So there were six children. They had three boys and three girls. Their oldest son, J.D., never had a name. He just had the initials. We called him Uncle Jerry. But since he was J.D. and the other boys, Uncle Austin and my dad, Uncle Jerry had a daughter. Uncle Austin had two daughters. So my father was the only one that had a male heir to carry on the name. So I'm J.D. Tant the third. And my son is J.D. the fourth, and my grandson is J.D. the fifth. Of course, he was named after the president of the Confederacy. He was Davis, but my mother preferred David to Davis, so they put a D on the end of the name instead of an S. But I mean, there are still people today, some that knew him of him when they were children, and the stories about him. Of course, you never know whether they're just legends or whether they're actually true stories, but they just go on and on and on. You know, he and his and my grandmother knew their share of sickness and death and hardship and disappointment. Financially, the life was never easy. He was in San Francisco in 1906. Tried to stay, he's going to be preaching out there, tried to stay in a hotel in town, but they were all full, so he went out of town a little ways, and that was the night they had the great earthquake. And he came back in town the next day and did some help in the rescue work. But he preached all over, from the Carolinas to California. By 1911, he had preached in 11 states, I mean, more than 20 states. You know, this is, you know, your transportation pretty slow back then. You didn't have the chance to get around like you do today. Drive your automobile or fly or even take a bus. And he was always interested and always had a tender spot in his heart for the orphan child. And they took children into their home and helped them many times along the way. And he was often called to help settle trouble among brethren, somewhat of an arbiter, because he didn't pull any punches. He'd tell it like it was, you know, and so they knew what they had to do to make things right. His last debate was with Ben M. Bogard. Ben Bogard was a champion among the Baptists. They had several debates together. I think they may have had about eight or nine times. One time in the debate, somebody he had debated several times, and the fellow, it may have been Bogard, in his speech said, "Well, Brother Elder Tan and I, says, we've been friends for a long time, says, we slept in the same bed last night."
Okay.
So I took a bath afterwards. And my grandfather, when he got up, says, "Well, yes, he did take a bath." I said, "I wish he'd taken one before." But... on his later years, he lived down the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, Los Fresnos and in Brownsville. And he wasn't the preacher then, but he was still preaching. Okay, but he would sit in a chair to preach because his strength was not good. He was nearly 80 years old. But here's a couple in the church who are, the rumor around town was that they were not acting right. They were not husband and wife. They were married to other people. But just things going around. It got pretty strong. And finally, one night, the service, why they came forward, make a confession, that they had not acted appropriately. You know, that they had left the wrong impression with some people. Well, my grandfather wasn't going to let it go. He got up on the platform, and it was a little bit hard of hearing. "Well, brethren, I didn't quite hear all that was said, but I'm so thankful they've confessed their adultery." Ooh. He said she could have cut him in half with her stare. But then a few weeks after that, I think maybe James Adam was preaching there at the time. A few weeks after that, James Adam was driving somewhere in another town about 30, 40 miles away, and here was this man's car parked in front of a little cafe, and that man and that woman were inside the cafe there. So I guess their confession may not have done too much good. He still had a good strong voice, and he had more time with his beloved Nanny than he had ever had before. And she wrote of him, "I believe he loved life more than any person I ever knew. Only a few more days before the end, he said to me, 'I'd be willing to live 1,000 years here if it were the Lord's will.' And I asked him if he could know that 1,000 years would have the same hardships, the incredible toil and labor of the 80 years he had lived, would he still be willing? He said yes." Only once. Only once did she hear a sentence fall from his lips that made her think that he might be longing for the end to come. Once, while sitting quietly in his chair on the front porch, he said, "There remaineth therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And I long for that rest." So on Tuesday afternoon, June the 3rd, 1941, about 4:30 in the afternoon, he fell asleep while visiting several friends who had dropped by to visit with him. He had requested a... there they were when he was 60 and she was 50. Here he is in Middleton, Hardeman County, Tennessee, probably in the 30s, you know. He loved little kids, so he had a picture made with these two little children. And here's the death certificate that was made out for him. And he had requested that H.D. Jeffcoat and James Adams conduct the service, which they did there. And the second service was in Central Church in Cleburne, Texas. W.K. Rose spoke. They had a long-term agreement that whoever survived the other would be the speaker at their funeral. G.H.P. Showalter read the scripture, and Cled Wallace, Foy's brother, had a short talk, and then Brother Rose and Foy Wallace Jr. So there are a lot of gospel preachers that were there to pay tribute to this soldier of the cross. And that's where they're buried, there in Cleburne, Texas. And my grandmother lived for some nearly 20 years after that. As I said, she died in 1961. And if you haven't read the book, you need to read one or both of the books. They've got a few of them out there in the front. And I've got a few. This one was out of print, but they're reprinting it. My father wrote this in 57, 58. And what I understand is that there have been more of this soul than of any biography of any gospel preacher through the ages. It's still in print. Although that's, 50 years ago. And it's a great story. And I've got a few books, but I brought them, but I gave them to the lady at the bookstore out there because they didn't have any. Because they'd called up the Faith and Facts, and they said they didn't have any more. They were reprinting it right now. I've got just a few more minutes. I've got to read something that my grandfather wrote. This is June 28th, and I'm 72 years old today. I've been thinking of the more than 8,000 people I baptized during my last 50 years. Way over here in Arkansas, where I'm preaching the gospel to many Baptists, by way of debate, who never heard it before, I'm reminded of the old days in Arkansas and of how their customs stack up with their present-day practices. A few days ago, an old brother, after hearing me preach 3 times in Houston, Texas, came to me and said, "Brother Tant, I'm glad I've heard you preach. You are not the type of man I'd expected to meet. It has been told on you by certain of your preaching brethren that you are vulgar in the pulpit. They say that you are rough and abusive, unrefined and uneducated, that you are so plain in your preaching that refined people could not listen to you. Since hearing you, I have decided that such reports are preachers' lies, prompted by jealousy and not by the love of God. As a further illustration, I recently received a letter from a good sister saying, 'We are dead here and doing no good. Many of us would like to have you come hold a meeting, but our elders say that you're too tough on the brethren, too hard on the other churches, and that we must have a man the denominations would like to hear.' A letter from a Baptist preacher who wants to meet me in debate in town where one of our leading Bible colleges is located says he has talked to several of our younger preachers there, and they say, Brother Tran is too old to debate, and he doesn't have a college education. Well, I'll admit that I have not the good English that N.B. Hardiman has. Neither can I measure up to G.C. Brewer's Law of Culture and Refinement, because I frequently go barefooted when I sleep. I preach in my shirt sleeves and put pencils in the outside coat pocket. Neither have I the refined disposition of Brother Sam Pittman. I'm just an old-fashioned, plain gospel preacher from the frontier. But I'm now ready to count coonskins with any of our modern college-educated, women-pleasing preachers. I have this month rounded out 52 years of plain gospel preaching. I baptized approximately 8,000 men and women. More than 100 of the boys I baptized in bygone years are now out preaching the gospel. I wonder if God will reject all those souls I have been instrumental in leading to Him merely because I'm not refined, because I do not wear a coat all the time. Count my coonskins, brethren, before you get too hard on me. One of the ablest preachers we have in Arkansas lost his located job, not because he was not preaching the gospel, but because one of the influential sisters in the church could not bear to listen to his old-fashioned language. She did not like Arkansas grammar, and thus could not invite her denominational friends to hear him. I doubt if the poor thing could tell whether Christ was crucified at Calvary or shot at Bunker Hill. I've tried to do the best I could to serve God in the backwoods and out-of-the-way places where a college degree is not so important. When brethren condemn me on account of my rough manners and plain speech, I shall not be too upset about it, but shall speak kindly of them and pray for them. And after life's battles have been fought and we all come before God to be judged, I may not be able to produce much refinement and education, but I shall say, Lord, I have done the best I could among the common people. I may go to hell on account of some meanness that I've done, but even so, I shall be happy to know that some of the souls I have helped save are in heaven because of my work. And when I meet some of my brethren in hell who have consistently violated God's law as found in Romans 14:13, we can at least have some satisfaction down there in counting coonskins and telling of the work we did while on earth. Each one of us should strive to fill his own corner and not throw rocks at his brother in another corner. Don't forget, brethren, we are drifting. Thank you all for the opportunity. Thank you for the time. Thank you.